everybody for their prayers. I wasn't going to do this, but I'm doing it. I suffer from another disease, and I'm now taking chemotherapy, and I want to thank everybody for their prayers, and I'm asking everybody here, I know that miracles happen here, and I know I'm going to have one. And I think one of the other big suggestions that I might do before I'm done was a fashion tip that I got this afternoon. I may trade this damn wig for a red one. Introduce this gentleman from, he's going to have to pronounce it again after all this, from California. Let's keep it simple, huh? And I'm telling you, if you don't know where his story is in the big book, you're going to have to go and look it up because there's no index.
That's a pretty good lean-in to us, huh, Cartier? My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. I also am the adult husband of a grateful member of Al-Anon. Well, they sure pack a lot of drunks in this one room, don't they? Hasn't this been a great weekend so far? Each AA group is like individuals. Each person has their own own personality. And I like some people better than others. I like some groups better than others. And it has to do with personality. It has to do with attitude. And you guys have a terrific attitude. And I'm very conscious of that ever since early in sobriety, when somebody said that the letters AA stand for altered attitudes. Attitude is just about everything, it seems to me. And you guys have a terrific attitude. I love it. There's one thing, though, that I miss I see more of back home in California. You're very friendly, and you put your hand out. You shake hands a lot, but you don't hug nearly enough. And I'd like to see you all stand up and everybody hug at least two other people right now. Thank you. Bruce, a meeting? Besides, in this chilly weather, you need something like that to warm it up. And anyway, I want to thank the committee for inviting Max and I to be here. And they wouldn't have needed to give Max quite as much time as they did. She tends to exaggerate things a lot. She likes a little sympathy. And actually, you never know from the way she tells it, but boy, she drove me to drink for years. And she's had a long time at it, too, a lot of practice. As she was pointing out, she was born in Butler, and I was born in Canton, Ohio. And grew up in, when I was 4 years old, my father, without even asking my opinion, gave up his job as a druggist in Canton, Ohio, and he bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio. And I literally grew up in a drugstore. And one of the bigger, more important aspects to that was that next door to the Oliger's drugstore was where Grandma Genslein was raising her granddaughter. She had her granddaughter Maxine and her two alcoholic sons. So that Max grew up in this home with these two alcoholic sons, and then she had an alcoholic uncle. And as Max and I were growing up, my family wasn't all that thrilled with me playing with the Genslein girl, because they were afraid the Gensleins didn't have that good a reputation, and they were afraid that when I grew up I might turn out to be an alcoholic, and by God they were right. I wasn't an alcoholic when I married her. Not everybody knows how they got to be an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic by marriage. So we've actually known each other since we were 4 years old. And The end of this year, December the 2nd of this year, we will have been married for 53 years. Wow, that wow is right. It's interesting what an important part she plays in my sobriety and what an important part she played in, as I say, driving me to drink. But it's been an interesting relationship, and it's interesting to see the part that it plays in both recovery and working together on the thing. And it's our way of life. We really enjoy AA and Al-Anon, and even our two Al-A-Dogs. They said to tell you hello. They're not too thrilled with you because we had to fly here to get here. And if we come by car, they come with us. They come to all of our AA and Al-Anon meetings. I go to Al-Anon with Max. We'll go to Monday noon meeting on Monday, and she comes to all my AA meetings, and the dogs come to all our meetings. They come to more meetings than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. They have nicer personalities than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. And it's just a way of life with us. That's what we do. And we love the program. It's interesting to me that I like the program so much, considering the fact that I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. How are yourself? I didn't even have to come here. I wasn't sent here by the judge. I didn't have a get well nudge from the judge or anything like that. I didn't have to come. It's just that coming to AA, getting a pass to come to AA was the only way I could get a pass to get off the nut ward. The nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. There's nothing funny about being on the nut ward. In fact, I found it rather boring and rather difficult. I mean, these people had a fascination with the idea of making leather belts. They were always trying to convince me that my life would be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. And I didn't see that at all. It didn't make any sense to me at all. I'd gone to pharmacy school, and I went to graduate school, and I went to medical school, then I got an internship and residency, and I specialized in internal medicine, and I listened to a lot of lectures, and I've been to a lot of seminars, and I've read a lot of books, and I have a lot of certificates. I've got a wall full of certificates to prove that I've been educated way beyond my intelligence. And these people are trying to tell me that if I learn how to make leather belts, the quality of my life will improve. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. But that wasn't my fault. That's the fault of the occupational therapist, because I've always known if you don't understand a thing well enough, you can explain it to me so that I understand it, then you don't really understand it as well as you think you do. And that poor girl had explained it to me three times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a fourth time. I wouldn't make their damn leather belts. I have no idea why going to AA helped me with making leather belts. I've been to all kinds of AA functions ever since. I've been to retreats and roundups and conventions and seminars and all kinds of things. And I've been to all kinds of any kind of an AA function. I want to experience it. I want to experience every AA experience I can. And yet I've never been to anyone where they had a occupational therapy booth. I mean, there's a lot of cabins and a lot of campfires and stuff here, but I haven't seen an occupational therapy booth. And yet, for some reason or other, going to the few AA meetings, I was able to go back to that nut ward, and I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. A pair of moccasins and a half a wallet. And those moccasins were nice, too, I'll tell you. They look good, and they fit good, and they wore well. They wore real well. In fact, the tongs to break, I'd repair them. It took 7 years. before those moccasins wore out to the point where I couldn't repair them anymore. And I felt bad. Not bad enough to go back and make another pair, but I... apparently Max was afraid that I might, and for my 7th AA birthday, my dear Al-Anon wife had my moccasins bronzed. And I love my bronze moccasins. I wish I had brought them here. I'd like to have shown you the workmanship, but there was a... I love my bronze moccasins, even though they're not nearly as comfortable anymore. I think it's interesting that I like AA as much as I do. As I said, considering the fact I wasn't even an AA when I came, I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. And I came to these meetings for 7 months before I turned into an alcoholic. I found out that's how you get alcoholism. I thought you got alcoholism by drinking alcohol. That's not true. You get drunk drinking alcohol. But you get alcoholism by associating with other alcoholics. It's a contagious disease. It's a virus. It's a virus, and it affects your brain, and it goes in through your ears. It's not funny. It's a serious disease. You die of it, and you can't get rid of it, as a matter of fact. And if you're here tonight and you're not really, really, really an alcoholic, you want to be very careful what you listen to. Keep your mind wide open. Keep it wide open so whatever goes in goes right on through. So the thought stops and you think, my God, I felt like that and I did something like that. And most of all, I felt like that when I did. You suppose I might be a boom just like that. You're an alcoholic. It is, once you suspect it, it's already too late, you know. And you won't even get any sympathy here. You turn to the guy next to you and say, I think I might be a boom. Hey, we got another one over here, fellas. Give him a hand. Here, go to him. You keep coming back, you know. You'll never get well. Ha, ha, ha. I thought, hell, I don't want this. I'll give it to somebody else. That made it worse, you know. The more you give it away, the more you got it, you know. And they tell you that it's a progressive disease, and it is. It's a progressive disease. My disease was progressing all the time out there, but it progresses even after you stop drinking. When I first became alcoholic, I was hardly alcoholic at all. Just a little bit alcoholic. And I'm much more alcoholic today. I keep getting reinfected every time I listen to another drunkologue. It's a progressive thing. In fact, as I say, I'm much more alcoholic now. When I first became an alcoholic, I was hardly alcoholic at all. In fact, I was certainly not your typical alcoholic. I was more allergic to alcohol. I was a mild form of a mild type of alcoholic. I had a list of things I wasn't. I wasn't a wino or a winette, as Clara says. I wasn't a chronic alcoholic. I wasn't a chronic inebriate. I certainly was not a Skid Row bum. But I was allergic to alcohol. I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. I do weird and peculiar things when I drink alcohol. I can't drink safely, sanely, sensibly. I can't drink worth a damn. As far as I react peculiarly to alcohol. And one of the things is alcohol makes me thirsty. Alcohol makes me thirsty. It's a funny thing. I haven't had a drink for... Yeah, that's worth talking about, by God. The last day of July of this year, a month and almost 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 25th AA birthday. impressed as I am. That is the longest I have ever gone without a drink. 25 years, a month, and 2 weeks is a long time between drinks for me. Yeah. And the funny part of it is, I'm not even thirsty. Yeah. When I was drinking, 25 hours was too long to go without drinking. But now that I'm not drinking, the more I drink, the thirstier I am. And I remember when I first became an alcoholic, and I remember that stuff they said about... They say a lot of dumb things around AA. One of them was that we just don't drink today. Now, you know they're lying when they say that. And yeah, I know they don't drink, ever drink. And I thought, well, when I became an alcoholic, and I said, every time I quit drinking, I always ended up drunk. And I thought, well, I'll try that. I just won't drink today. So I'll just won't drink today just to see what happens. And nothing happened. So I decided to try it another day, and nothing happened that day. And that's the way I've been doing it. I drank many yesterday, and I'm certainly going to drink tomorrow. In fact, I don't know that I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. But I drank many yesterday, I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. Today's the day I don't drink. Today's a very important day for me. This is the day I don't drink. I'm going to drink tomorrow. And when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time, and if it's today, I won't drink today. I haven't been drunk since the last time I quit drinking. And that has worked well for me. And as I say, I react peculiarly. I used to go to church dinner dances. That was one of the things we did back in Alliance. I used to have to go to church dinner dances. You grow up in a drugstore, you have to go to church dinner dances, get to know people and build up. It's good to build up business. I don't like church dinner dances. Don't like them at all. A lot of people at church dinner dances. And you have to talk to people at the dinner. They expect you to talk chit-chat. I don't like to talk chit-chat. And you have to dance. You can't not dance at a church dinner dance. You can't not dance at a church dinner dance. Because every church dinner dance has at least one hyperactive woman. You're sitting there minding your own business, and she runs up and says, "Come on, Paul, let's dance." And I say, "No, I don't dance." They say, "Oh, sure you do." And they drag you out on the floor and prove that you don't dance. But in retrospect, I can think back now. I don't know that I thought of it at the time, but I can see now that I would have a couple of drinks before I go to church dinner. You have to be very careful at a church dinner dance. You have to have a drink, because if you don't drink, they'll think you have a drinking problem. And if you drink too much, they'll know you have a drinking problem. So you drink before you go. And I would have a few drinks before I go there, and that would relax me mentally, it would relax me physically, relax me mentally, and I could chit-chat. Oh, I could chit-chat real good. I was a real good chit-chatter. And relax me physically, and I could dance. But I really dance good. Real fine. Today I don't drink and I don't dance. The problem was the two got out of sync. I mean, over the years, I got out of sync. There were times when I wouldn't be at all relaxed mentally yet, and I would get too relaxed physically. It might affect my tongue and my speech, and I would talk slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice. Or I would trip when there was nothing to trip. I'd be lying there, just lying there, looking very serene. And my brain would say, "Get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk." My brain would say, "What do you mean, get up? We can't move. We're paralyzed from the ears down." I wonder why. We must be allergic to this stuff. I never heard of anybody that could get paralyzed from the ears down on a couple of drinks. I'll have to ask somebody about that. I was thinking maybe a professor of allergies or something. I never found anybody to ask. I thought that was very strange that alcohol would infect me. I never knew anybody affected that way. But I never found anybody to ask. You can't ask just anybody. You can't. They're liable to say dumb things like, "Well, I don't know why it does it to you, but if it does do that to you, why don't you just not drink it?" I didn't want to know what to do about it. I just wanted to know why it did that to me. And there'd be other times, you know, I hadn't even begun to relax physically yet, and I would get too relaxed mentally. It'd be like as if all my brain cells would get together and say, "Oh, what the hell? He's drinking. Let's take the night off." You know. And then go on back home, go to bed, you know. And my body would go on doing things, you know. And in the morning, I'd try to figure out what my body had been doing when my brain was home in bed. And I have never yet found out how to recall something that wasn't recorded at the time that it happened. And I guess the longer I drank, the more unpredictable it was. As I say, alcohol makes me thirsty. And in AA, we just don't drink. That was one of my first impressions in AA, was that there are such fanatics on this not drinking stuff. And even the use of words, they talked about sober. This guy have a couple of beers, you know. Perfectly sober as could be and have a couple of beers. And they say, "You're drunk." What do you mean drunk? Drunk means you're falling down. I mean, you're not drunk. You're drinking doesn't mean you're drunk unless you're falling down. And they even talk about beer and wine. You're drinking. Well, beer and wine, that's what I drank when I wasn't drinking. But in AA, they're such fanatics. That's all they talk. I used to go to meetings, and that's all they talk about, drinking, drinking, drinking. I wanted to talk about my problems. I had really serious problems I want to talk about. All they want to talk about drinking, drinking, drinking. I don't understand these people. That's all they talk about is drinking, drinking, drinking. It makes my car thirsty. We stop at the liquor store on the way home. That's the way it is now. We don't drink. We just don't drink. We just don't drink. That's a fundamental, basic thing in AA. We just don't drink. We don't drink no matter what. No matter what. We just don't drink. No matter what. We just don't drink. We don't drink. No matter what. We don't drink. We don't even drink when we're supposed to drink. You know, people have a party or they have a celebration or a wedding or graduation or any kind of celebration. They buy good liquor and they invite you to come and celebrate with them. That's what they invite you there for. You're supposed to drink. We'll have a cup of coffee. I'll have a Diet Coke, please. We have sissy drinks. Yeah. We just don't drink. We just don't drink. We don't even drink when we want to drink. Other people that want to drink, they pick up a drink and drink it. We want to drink, we pick up the phone. Say, "Hey, man, I want to drink." Yeah. We don't drink no matter what. We don't even drink when we deserve a drink. Yeah. Many a time in the last 25 years, I deserved a drink. Yeah. My sponsor would say, "Boy, there's nothing wrong with you that a good stiff drink wouldn't take care of." You just decide I deserved it, but I couldn't have it. And we just don't drink, no matter what. So I go on to lots of meetings and all this other stuff and working the steps over and over again, having the sponsor. Daily prayer and all that stuff. I find it easier and easier to stay sober. It's just not an option for me anymore. I not only don't drink, I don't even take a pill. Of course, this is an AA meeting, we talk about alcohol, but I do feel I need to give at least honorable mention to amphetamines. I have been one or two amphetamine users. I don't know that I would have had the stamina to have stayed out there long enough to have completed my pre-AA training period if it hadn't been for amphetamines. They really helped me a lot. I mean, they did affect my hearing, though, and I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying a lot of times. "What are you saying? What are you saying that again for? You've already said it three times." "I don't know. It just sounds too good. I think I'll say it again." You know. But I took other pills too. But I never became hooked on pills. I never got addicted on pills. Oh, yourself. You ask any doctor how you people get hooked. You ask him how his patients get hooked on pills. He'll tell you two things. First off, none of his patients ever get hooked on pills. And the other thing he'll tell you is the patient always abuses the pills. You don't get hooked on pills unless you abuse them. I never abused a pill in my life. I don't even know how to abuse a pill. How do you throw it up against the wall? Abuse it, kick it around, verbally abuse it, you dirty rotten little pill. Right? You know what I tell you? The pill in my life. They're very tiny little pills. You just look at them, you can tell they're very mild. And I was very careful where I carried them even. I used to put them over here with my change. And people would say, "You got change for a dollar?" And you say, "Oh, yes." And you go like that. And they say, "Oh, you're carrying Nembutal around in the daytime." You know? So I put it over with my keys. And you go to get in your car, and you take your keys out of your pocket, and a Quaalude runs down the street, you know. The damn thing always runs faster than you can run. You know? And you can't stomp on it or you'll abuse it. So I never abused a pill in my life. Anyhow, I ended up in a nut ward. That's what I did. Yeah, I do all these things, and I don't. Drinking is no longer an option for me, and taking a pill is no longer an option for me. And I went to all these things, so I don't really have. As long as it's not an option, just like Max and I used to argue all the time, we'd get to arguing, and one of us would bring up divorce, and then we'd be fighting over divorce until we finally decided divorce was no longer an option. And when that's no longer an option, then you have to figure out how to get along. In fact, it happens to me a lot. I'll get all upset about something, and now that we've been around a little while, and a little voice will say to me, "This thing you're all upset about, is it really all that important?" And I say, "Hell yes, it's important." And then the little voice will say, "Yeah, but is it important enough to drink over?" I say, "Hell no, nothing's worth getting drunk over." The little voice says, "Well, you're not going to reward yourself with a drink. Why bother to be so upset?" And I have to figure out another way to handle the thing. But the voices in my head, I have a dual problem. I have a drinking problem and a thinking problem. And AA has been much more dramatic in removing my drinking problem. It's been a little slower on my thinking problem. And all my problems today are thinking problems. I don't even have a problem today, unless I think I do. I have never ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. If I think I have a problem, I have a problem. I alone determine whether or not I have a problem. I alone determine the size of my problem. If I think it's a big problem, it's a big problem. If I think it's a little problem, no matter what anybody else thinks, it's a little problem. I don't have very many little problems. I don't bother with them. They're like the resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. In fact, my life is determined by my thinking. It isn't what happens to me that matters. It's what I think about what happens that matters. And my life is determined by what I focus my attention on. My mind is like a giant energy factory, and it puts energy out, like in a powerful searchlight or laser beam, and I have to be careful what it focuses on, because whatever it looks at, it begins to grow. It puts the energy into it. And my that's both good and bad. The bad part is that my mind tends to go off on its own looking for things to look at, you know. And it'll find it, and it'll watch something grow and grow. And I can take any little old problem, and I don't have to work on it. All I have to do is just think about it. And I can just watch it grow and grow and grow. And in fact, I don't even have to start out with a little problem. I can start out with a not. Hell, that's no problem. Oh, I suppose if you thought about it enough. Yeah, well, it is a kind of a problem. Pretty soon I'm just watching the thing get bigger and thinking about it. And pretty soon I think, my God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. You know, everybody else is missing it, you know. And I get so overwhelmed by it. And people can't help you much with a problem like that. They tell you dumb things. They say, well, don't worry about it. Well, I don't know how to, don't think about it. They'll say, I don't know how to not think about something I'm obsessed with. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And my mind, I don't know how you think, but sometimes I wonder how some of you think, but I think by somebody talking to me. My thinking is always somebody talking to me. As a matter of fact, even that, and I have these people in my head. All these personal, you think there's a lot of people in this room, it's nothing compared to my head. I mean, all these personalities in my head, each one's has a different focus, a different idea, a different thing about life, and then talks about it. And that's what they're doing now. I'm trying to talk to you, and you're nice and quiet and sitting there, and they're up there chattering among themselves as to what I ought to be talking about. And they even get to arguing among themselves about what I ought to say and what the next topic is, and it's very distracting, and I tend to lose my way, and I think to them, God, why don't you people shut up there? And they all get startled and shut up, and then I can't think of anything to say. And the focus of my life is by these people up there. And this one up there is really only one. There's only one who has this idea is that no matter what the situation is, no matter what's going on, whether it's a problem or a celebration or whatever it is, he's always got one idea. Let's have a drink. And whoever I listen to tends to move to the front of the room and talk more and talk the loudest. Now, the one who says, let's have a drink, and there's a lot of them, they have really, some of the ideas some of them have are illegal, lewd. I used to fight with them. Now, I don't fight with them anymore at all because they're all part of me, so I don't want to fight with myself. So I just say, thank you for participating. Now, if you'll sit down, we'll call in somebody else. And they grumble a bit and wander to the back of the room. But the guy that talks about drinking, he's still there. He's waiting for his chance when I'll pay more attention to him, and then he'll come up with his idea again. But so nobody ever leaves, but they tend to move to the back of the room and they're quiet. And I find getting along with them up there is more important than getting along with them out there, which is where I thought is what I had to do. I thought if I got along with them out there, I'd be comfortable in here. I find out in the program, if I'm comfortable with the people in my head, then they have a change of personality out there, and I can get along with them. An interesting thing about that, too, is that in all this group of all these people in my head, and all this chatter and all this talking that's going on, in the very, very center, of me, there's a center of calm. And I find that's where my higher power is. That's where my higher power is. It's in a center of calm deep within me. And I like that. I like that because that means no matter where I go, he's with me. He's always there. One of the things I find interesting is to try, if that's where he is with me, then that's where he is with you. In fact, he's a lot of other places, but he's also in the very center of us. And I find in talking to another alcoholic, if the center of calm in me can talk to the center of calm in the other alcoholic, that we have tremendous communication. And a thing I found interesting to do is a number of months ago, I was at a convention in San Diego, and the gal a couple thousand people at the meeting. And at the end of the meeting on Saturday night, she said, when we close the meeting and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer, instead of looking at the floor or closing your eyes, try looking in the eyes of the other alcoholics. And I've tried doing that, and when the center of calm in me meets the center of calm in the other person, I find it hard to keep from smiling. And the more I do that, the more I'm sure that's where he is. I have the feeling he's been hiding where we least expect to find him. And I find that very comforting, and glad to be aware of that. I used to fight to get to sleep. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a sleeping problem. And I if you want to grow crazy sometime, decide you have a sleeping problem and decide to work on it. I got to where I used to worry all day about whether or not I'd sleep at night. And the next step was where I'd worry all night about whether I'd sleep at night. It started out when I drank a couple of beers. I went to pharmacy school. My whole family went to pharmacy school. My father went to the University of Pittsburgh pharmacy school when it was a two-year course. My older brother and older sister went there when it was a three-year course. I went there when it was a four-year course. Now I understand it's at the university and it's a six-year course. And I got my degree in pharmacy and worked in the family drugstore at home, but people weren't as impressed with my pharmacy degree as I thought they ought to be. They weren't as impressed as I was. I decided they'd be more impressed if I had a medical degree. But it was my family didn't have the money to send me to medical school. They didn't want me to go to medical school. They wanted me to stay home and work in the family drugstore. So my solution was to marry the girl next door and suggest that she work my way through medical school. So that's how Max and I got married, and we got the medical degree, and people weren't all that impressed with that either. And I thought they'd be more impressed if I had a specialty degree. And so I said, you're doing a good job, kid. You keep on working, and we'll get us a specialty degree. And she did, and I did. And we got a degree in internal medicine. And then I let her work in the office for 25 years for free. I thought it was the least I could do since she had worked my way through school. And that's what you do in internal medicine. You're a diagnostician. People come to you, they want two things. They want a label. They say, what's wrong with me, doc? So you give them a name, a label. You say, oh, you got ickus of the bickus. Yeah. And they say, oh, I got ickus of the bickus. And then they ask their second question, what are you going to give me for it, doc? And you give them a pill. And I had a prescription pill for every ill. And I was a good diagnostician, and Max and I built up a big practice. And we even had our own version of the Hippocratic Oath, or I had my own version of the Hippocratic Oath, in that I never ever gave a patient a pill that I hadn't first tried out on myself. But back in pharmacy school, I found I had trouble getting to sleep at night, and I drank a couple of, I found that I could drink a couple of beers and jump in bed and sleep real fast. And, you know, when I did that, there's only two kinds of drinking, either social drinking or alcoholic drinking. And when I was drinking two beers to get to sleep at night, that's not social drinking. I was drinking to solve a living problem. And the interesting thing about it was, it worked. And any time I ever used a chemical to solve a living problem, it worked. But because it worked, it made me less able to solve that problem without the chemical the next time. And it also took more of the chemical over a period of time to get the same effect. And also the effect lasted for shorter and shorter periods of time, so I had to take it at increasingly shorter intervals. And also, over a period of time, it had side effects, so I had to take other chemicals to counteract the side effects. So it was really a very progressive thing. And my taking a couple of beers in order to get to sleep at night It started at one end. At the other end, I was shooting Pentothal in my vein at night to get to sleep at night. And you know, Pentothal is that stuff when you go to surgery, they don't put a mask over your face and pour ether on it and say, breathe deep like they used to. They put a needle in your vein and run an IV in, and they give you Pentothal and say, count to 10, and you say 1, and zing, you're asleep. Instant blackout is what it is. It's kind of nice, as a matter of fact. Not as nice as intravenous Demerol, but it's nice. I used to put myself to sleep with that. And it was a hard thing to do because I couldn't lie in bed and have my one daughter yell the other daughter, hey, Ann, come watch Daddy take his nightly fix. I would keep the Pentothal in the bag in the car, in the garage, and thank God the garage was attached to the house. And I would decide a hard day's work and a hard day of pill taking and an evening of drinking. I decided it was time to go to bed. I'd go out in the garage and mix up the Pentothal, put it in a string, stick the needle in my vein. And I figured out how many pills have I had, how much have I had to drink, how many uppers in contrast to how many downers, how much can I get squirt in here and take it out, throw it in the bag in the car, slam the car door, run down the hall and jump in bed so I could fall asleep. It was very hard to time it. I took all my pharmaceutical and medical training together, because I had to have it just right, just the least little bit too much, and I'd just zing right under the car. Or worse than that, the least little bit, not enough, and I'd squirt it in, take it out, throw it in the back, slam the car door, run down the hall and jump in bed, and nothing would happen. Yeah. Half measures got you nowhere on that deal. I had to go back and do it all over again. And I ended up doing that. One time I did that, I think it was 4 times in one night. And, wow, that's right. And in the morning I got to thinking about that. And I thought, you know, that's not social sleeping. I had to give that up. That comes under chemical sobriety. Father Barney used to come down to... what time did I start on? 8? I don't care. I don't know. I got nothing to do until my plane at 8 in the morning. Father Barney used to come down from the Seattle area and put on retreats in our area. And he used to talk about, he used to divide sobriety up into, he said it was like a baseball diamond. He said first base was physical sobriety, second base was mental sobriety, third base was emotional sobriety, and home plate was spiritual sobriety. I like that. I thought, yeah, I wonder how I got to first base, because I hadn't really sought it out as such. And then somebody said, well, you can't get to first base without starting at home plate. And so I thought, I like that. And it seemed to me, I see a lot of people who get to first base and try to steal the rest of the bases and often get thrown out. Yeah. They're real lucky they get another chance at bat. But it seems to me the steps are on there. You get to the first base, and shortly after first base, it's time for the first step. And then the second step comes before mental sobriety, the second base. And emotional sobriety requires the third, fourth, fifth steps. And the steps are, in fact, I find that all, and I like to add in there marital sobriety, as well as emotional and mental sobriety. And it seems to me that we're always on that diamond. We're always at any one point in time. Sobriety is not a place, it's a process. And at any moment in time, I'm either moving back toward a drink or further into spiritual sobriety. And it's an interesting journey to keep moving. In fact, it seems to me that there's no end to the this thing. If my life was put on a chart, it would start way over there. And it's going to end way, way over there someplace. Oh, you mentioned your illness. reminds me of mine. I digress to tell you about my experience. First part of this year, Max joined an old fogies type medical coverage type thing, Secure Horizons. And I thought it would be good if we both were on the same program. So I joined it too. And as part of joining this Secure Horizons thing, they had a physical exam and some lab work. And they did blood tests, PSA tests, found out that I had an indication of cancer of the prostate biopsy. He biopsied it. It came back highly malignant. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was an 8 to 10. 4 plus 4, whatever that meant. Then they decided they have to have a radical mastectomy. Okay. Not something I voted for, but I made the mistake of taking the third step. Now I got to take what happens. And the only problem was that the urologist was so afraid of socialized medicine that his way to fight socialized medicine was to hate anybody with a prepaid medical plan. And he showed it. And I thought, I am not going to be cut open by a disgruntled surgeon. So I fired him. And I went back on Medicare. The only trouble is, it took me until the first part of April to get back on Medicare. So during that time, I literally sat on my cancer and waited. And somebody on the program got me an appointment with the associate professor of urology at UCLA Medical Center. I went to see him. Great guy. Took a very aggressive approach to treatment, started me on the treatment right away, doing all the things he could do prior to doing surgery, which he couldn't do until April, first part of April. I ended up having my surgery in the first part of April at the UCLA Medical Center. I thought I better get a private room. I don't want my roommate to have to bother with a lot of possible visitors. The private rooms at UCLA Medical Center are all on the ninth floor. The ninth floor of the UCLA Medical Center is known as the Wilson Pavilion. I had my surgery on the Wilson Pavilion by the associate professor of urology of UCLA Medical Center. He's a urologist, not a proctologist, but they're next door neighbors. They can't both work at the same time. I was on the Wilson Pavilion, and my urologist's name was, believe it or not, Dr. Bob Smith. So I feel fine. I mean, just think of all the trouble my higher power went through to set that up. But I wouldn't be surprised the guy didn't even want to be a urologist. You know. Anyway, that's where that is. Anyway, I was on my chart, and my life chart was going to end way over there. And during the drinking time, my life was on a downhill course. It was on a downhill, but it wasn't straight down. It was up and down, up and down. There was enough ups to it to keep me from realizing how it was going down. I think it was a straight line down. I might have been recognized, but every time it went up, I thought I was making it. I thought I was getting somewhere. I didn't realize when it went down, it was downer than it was before the last time it went down. And it ended up going down, and I ended up in the Networth Hospital. And 7 months later, on July 31st, 1967, I accepted the fact that I, of all people, in spite of the fact I had nothing to do with it, had no choice in the matter, I was at least a mild kind of alcoholic. I accepted that. And my life has changed dramatically ever since, and been continuing to change ever since. Ever since then, started down in the basement, it's been coming up and up. Again, not a straight line up. It's up and down, up and down. But when it goes up, it's usually upper than it was the last time it was up. And when it doesn't go down as steep, when it goes down, it feels like I was down here, but I'm not. And it doesn't stay down as long. And it doesn't go down as often. But life is up and down, up and down. And it just keeps getting better and better. And I can't see that there's any end in sight as to how high that, the only thing that can control how high that is going to go, how much better my life is going to get, is how long I can stay around and keep doing this thing, doing all these things, doing this program. Because apparently the only limit, you can't possibly get everything. I don't think anybody can possibly get everything this program has to offer. All you can do is get the most you can get while you're here. And it's just, other than that, there's no limit to where we can go with this thing. And it just keeps getting better and better. Not only is it a progressive disease, but it's a progressive recovery. I think Clara said it today. It's a progressive recovery. And it's only limited by our enthusiasm, our energy, our attitude, and how long we can stay around doing it. And it seemed that it all started, this is what fascinates me, for me, it all started with that acceptance of the fact that I was an alcoholic. And I think, you know, why did that have such a profound effect on my life? What did I really do when I accepted my alcoholism? And I think what happened was I accepted the challenge. I think I accepted the challenge of living life successfully in spite of the fact that I couldn't drink like other people. Don't you feel sorry for me? I accepted whatever life had to offer, and life has been getting better and better. And it seems now that if that works so well for alcoholism, it seems to work for every aspect of my life. It's become a philosophy of mine to accept life on life's terms rather than to fight it. In fact, as long as I resisted the fact that I was an alcoholic, it kept getting worse. And once I accepted it, it's been getting better and better. And I find that life is like that. The more I resist life on life's terms, the worse it gets. And the more I accept life as it is, the better it keeps getting. And it seems so obvious, why do I tend to go back and want to resist it? We were talking about that on the way to the meeting tonight, about why is it so hard to let go and let God? Why is it so hard to let go? And I guess the answer is because if you let go, you can't be sure you're going to get your way. In fact, I remember years ago reading something that was in a little Jehovah's Witness or something like that, it was a circular, and it said, if you turn something over to God and you have any idea of how He ought to handle it, you haven't really turned it over. And I thought, gee, that's different. What if He doesn't have all the facts? You know, And it just seems to me that, you know, and the thing about the trouble with acceptance, there are a lot of troubles with acceptance. One is that it has no duration. No matter how intensely I accept life at my early morning meeting, by the time I get home, the situation has changed, and that acceptance of an hour before doesn't have any effect on this situation now. Nor does it isn't transferable from one situation to the next either. Acceptance doesn't transfer over. You have to keep doing it over and over again. And the biggest problem that I have with it is that acceptance is not approval. It's not approval. And we're taught approval. Everything in life is, we're taught that all the time. If you don't approve of something, don't buy it. If you don't approve of it, tell them about it. Complain. Don't be a wimp. You get something, you buy something, you get home, you find it's not what you thought it was. Don't keep it. Take it back. Be assertive. Take a course in assertion training. First thing they'll teach you is how to take something back you don't want. They'll probably have to take back something you do want, just to practice the thing. Be assertive. I remember one day we were in a courtroom. Max and I talked at a Al-Anon meeting. They were holding it in an empty courtroom, and there were some papers on the desk. I was sitting at the court secretary or court reporter's thing, and the papers, I picked it, being nosy, I picked it up, see what the papers said. There were stacked up. There were form letters. It says, what did you think of the judge? What did you think of the jury? What did you think of the attorneys? What did you think of that? And I thought, my God, they're even taking an inventory on how the courts run. It's if you don't approve, say so on the thing. The problem is that we live in two worlds. We live in the world out there, and we live in the spiritual world. And approval is all important out there, but in the inner world, it's of no importance at all. In fact, as far as I can tell, God doesn't even have a customer relations department. Don't have a complaint department. I can't imagine one of God's messengers running up to God and saying, oh my God, God, we've got a problem. Paul doesn't like the day we're sending him. I just imagine he can go to the devil. One of the things I'd like to learn in AA, in fact, what's the opposite of, if you don't accept, if you don't practice acceptance, what would be the term you would apply to what you are doing if you don't accept life on life's terms? Fight?
Denial.
What?
Denial.
Judge? How about whine? Pout? Complain? Bitch? Moan? Groan? They're all negative things. I can't, the alternatives to acceptance are, all of them are negative and make it worse. And acceptance makes it, well, in fact, what's the ultimate? What's the ultimate, if total acceptance is as far as you can go in one direction, what's the ultimate, the farthest you can go of non-acceptance? What? Drink? Pretty close. I same deal. I think the opposite of the total opposite would be suicide. Total rejection of life. You drink, or what's the use? And take a drink, or shoot your brains out, or whatever. But I think we don't have that. What I'm saying is, I don't think we have that many options. We might as well acceptance, because that's the way it's going to be anyhow. That's what I found out with the third step. When I finally did the third step, and really turned my will and my life over to the care of God, I found out that's where it had been all along anyhow. Only I didn't know that. You know. But I want to make sure he knew it, by God. I'm driving down the freeway real fast, and somebody says, "Let God do the driving." I'm willing to let go of the steering wheel, but I need to know that he's going to grab the thing, or that he knows that I'm letting go and he's responsible. In fact, when I did the third step, I didn't just do it casually. I went to a business supply store, and I bought a blank form for a limited partnership agreement. And I filled it out so that I literally, in writing, gave God a 51% controlling interest in my life and in my practice. And there are two parts to that, really. One is the partnership agreement to show that a partnership exists, and the other one is a form written thing that tells what the terms of the partnership are. Who's going to do what, in other words. And ultimately, what it came down was to what I wrote it all out. What was his part, what was my part. What it really comes down to is that he's in charge, I'm in charge of work, and he's in charge of worry. And he doesn't even like me to help him with his part of the thing, and he never comes down and does any of the work. my agreement, and then fourth and fifth step, I've done those quite thoroughly. I've done five real thorough fourth and fifth steps in innumerable spot inventories. And the sixth and seventh step, I've done them more recently again, and I find they are very different later in sobriety than they are in the beginning. In fact, if you look in the big book, there's only six or seven lines description of the sixth and the seventh step in the big book, but a whole chapter to it in the 12 and 12. In fact, the first sentence under the sixth step in the 12 and 12 says, "This is the step that separates the men from the boys." And I think that the point being that after you've been sober a while, they come out entirely different. I see a lot of people who are drifting away from the program after 5, 6, 7 years and deciding maybe they need to get something else. They're not going to as many meetings, and the sponsor has moved away, or they moved away. And anytime you move away someplace else, they never are running the meetings right, and they end up deciding they're depressed and need something for that. I find that's the time when people need to get in and do the steps all over again and really hit the sixth and seventh step, and so on. Anyway, the steps have been a very, very important part of my life, and I love the powerlessness of the first step. I mean, I find that most of the things that we get most worked up about are something over which we're powerless anyway. And we're worked up over somebody, we're trying to change somebody else's attitude. And that's really difficult to do. The one last thing I want to talk about is the fact that nobody knows the cause of alcoholism. Nobody knows the basis of it. Nobody but me, that is. I have my own, it's just a theory, but it's my theory, and therefore it's right. And even if it's wrong, I don't even want to know about it. But my feeling is that an alcoholic is a person who, whether they want to or not, and perhaps even more so if they don't want to, but whether they want to or not, an alcoholic generates a great deal of love and lacks the ability to express love. And because they can't express it, it builds up like pressure in a tea kettle. And it becomes very painful. And they put in alcohol and maybe other drugs to suppress the feelings. That seems to help. But it makes it worse because it compounds the communication problem. So it just keeps getting worse and worse. The people who love us, we can not only not express love, we can't accept love. So the people that love us can't express their love either, ending up with essentially the same problem. And the pressure keeps building up and building up. It has to come out, and it can't come out as love. It comes out as negative emotions, anger, frustration, resentment, hatred, maybe even violence, all of which, of course, keep compounding the communication problem. Nothing you can do about a deal like that. Doctors can't help, lawyers can't help, people that and there's no place to go. When there's no place else to go, they finally end up as newcomers in AA or Al-Anon, or both. What do we do with newcomers? Seems to me we love the hell out of them. We literally love the hell out of their hellish lives. We don't tell them that. We don't run up and throw our arms around and say, I love you, scares the hell out of them. So we treat them with respect. We show them that we care. You know, the definition of love that I like is the one that says love is making the other person feel important. Now that's not too difficult. You remember their name, smile to them. Newcomer, you get them a cup of coffee, you get them a directory, you make them feel at home, you make them feel welcome. One of the reasons they make them feel welcome is because they are welcome. We have three parts to our disease. Alcoholism is a disease. It has a spiritual answer, and we have to give it away to keep it. So that if we don't have anybody to give it away to, we can't give it away, then we can't keep it, and so we'd all get drunk. So we need the newcomer. They are important. But we make them feel important. That's loving. And they begin, we don't, and we show them how to be loving, like we did right now. We sit and listen. We sit and listen. We act attentive, whether we are or not. We acted. And that's an act of love. Somebody gets up here and talks, and it's frightening, but they take whatever risk there is to it. That's an act of love. And sitting and listening to encourage them to do that, and thanking them afterwards, that's an act of love. We love each other to health. And the newcomer becomes part of that. And they end up staying sober or getting some serenity, and they don't even realize what's doing it. But it's love that's doing it. And that idea of making somebody feel important is the sort of thing that I thought maybe I could do that with Max. That would be, I could show her that I loved her rather than to keep telling her that I love her. And that I love you has too many meanings and stuff, it seemed to me. So I thought, well, one of the things I'll do, Max likes to wake up to a heart. She hates to wake up. But when she does wake up, she likes to wake up to a hot cup of coffee. Now, she doesn't like hot coffee, and she hates cold hot coffee. But she likes hot coffee with an ice cube in it that hasn't melted yet. Well, it's not asking too much, because if the ice cube's melted, then her day has started off with a problem. You know, did you put the ice cube in this coffee? So he likes to see it there, and then she knows it there. And so I figure I could do that for Max. I'll get her a cup of coffee every morning with an ice cube in it. And I get up before Max does. Actually, the whole world gets up before Max does. I get up, and I take care of Lily and Sabrina. And then I go to my computer, and I type a letter to God, and I do automatic typing. Great, one of the best things I've ever learned, to do type a letter to God. I used to get right in my gratitude list, and he got so bored with reading it. I said, please don't write any more of the gratitude list. I just tell him what a great job he's doing, and keep on doing it. And for him to have a good day, and I'll have a good day. And I tell him, you make happen today whatever you want to have happen. And you have come into my life whoever you want to have come into my life. And you have them say to me whatever you want them to say, and you have them do whatever you want them to do. And I'll know that whatever happens today, and whoever comes into my life, and whatever they say and do, I'll know that's your will for me today. Now you go have a real good day today, and I'll check back with you in the morning. And I, you know, and the first time I did that, I thought, my God, I wonder what he'll do. Is it safe to trust him? You know. And, if he has all that power, what'll he do with it, you know? And yet, you know, and I have never done that, and I've done it daily, almost, that I've never done that on any day, anything ever seemed to happen other than the way it was supposed to. Everything seems to have fallen in place. And another thing I do is if I have a problem, I'll do automatic writing. I'll sit down and write about the problem, writing as fast as I can, not stopping to think about it. If I can't think about what to say, I'll be writing that I can't think of what to say, but I got to keep the pen going, I got to keep writing. And I'll keep writing about the problem. And it's amazing how often the answer to the problem evolves before I finish describing the problem. And if it doesn't, it will often come to me later that day. Or that night, I'll awaken with it the next morning. Or it'll come to me the next morning when I'm thinking about something else. But it seems as almost as if there's a strong connection between my higher power and my computer in doing that. Then, yeah, by the time I get that all done, it's time for the queen to wake up. And I go to make Max her a cup of coffee. And she doesn't like brewed coffee particularly. She likes instant coffee. Don't moan. It's instant coffee as long as it's U-Ban. In fact, we met the couple here last night who sent us the U-Ban coffee cup from the coffee mug. It has to be U-Ban. U-Ban. She likes a level teaspoonful. She doesn't like it too strong. She doesn't like it weak. She likes a level teaspoonful. Put that in the bottom of the cup. And she doesn't like milk or cream. She likes cream ore. Likes lots of cream ore. Heaping teaspoons. Two heaping teaspoons full of cream ore. Real milky, like that. Put it in the bottom of the cup. You don't boil the water. You take the water out of a hot water dispenser. Hot water dispenser is a faucet over here, and the hose goes down under the sink. And you have to hire a man to install it. had to drill a hole about that big in the top of the stainless steel sink that replaced the perfectly good white porcelain sink that was there. But the hot water dispenser dispenses water at just the right temperature for putting an ice cube in it. Yeah. And you're running the water in, you swish the cup around like this so it mixes up the cream ore and the coffee in the bottom, because if you don't, it'll cake in the bottom. She doesn't like to get to the bottom of the cup and find that some of it's down there. She didn't get it all. But you don't want to swish it too much or it'll slosh over the side and make the bottom of the cup wet, and that makes it wet wherever you set it down. She doesn't like that, so it's dry on the bottom of the thing. And you don't want to fill it too full either, because you got to slide an ice cube in it. You can't drop it, and you got to slide it in so it doesn't slosh over the side. You don't want it wet on the bottom. And you get that ready, and you take it into the darkened bedroom. And be careful where you walk, because she steps out of her high-heeled shoes right where you're going to walk. And it's painful if you step on those in your bare feet. And you've got to be particularly careful when you go up along the side of the bed, because those glossy magazines are very slippery. And you get up to the head of the bed. You get up to the head of the bed, you don't look for a bare spot, you just look for a level spot, you know. And you set the cup of coffee down, and you turn around and you walk out, and you don't cheat. You don't do anything to wake her up. You walk out quietly, hoping she will wake up before the ice cube melts. Now that Now, that all is the easy part. The hard part of it is you don't dare expect her to appreciate it. Because if you expect her to appreciate it, it's not love. It's barter. Because Chuck C. used to always tell us that. Love is for free and for fun. Love is for free and for fun. Expecting nothing in return. Expecting nothing in return. If you even expect appreciation, it's not love. It's barter. Pretty damn strict rule, it seemed to me. But I have to admit right off, Max is very appreciative. I mean, Max is very cooperative. She never appreciates it. So, yeah. And that's how I make Max a cup of coffee. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I guess maybe I didn't mention that. Yeah. I'm not proud to be an alcoholic. I mean, why would I be proud to be an alcoholic? I mean, it's something I had nothing to do with. But I'm certainly not ashamed of it. Not the least bit ashamed of being an alcoholic. Why would I be ashamed of something I had no control over? In fact, I didn't ever chose to be an alcoholic. I'm not sure I became an alcoholic by accident. So I'm neither proud nor ashamed of being an alcoholic. But I'm mighty proud. Mighty proud. Mighty proud indeed to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that is absolutely terrific, and I thank you very much for that. Good night.